Today's forum will be looking at the upcoming Somalia election. Our moderator today is Mary Harper, who is the Africa editor, BBC News, and is the author of Getting Somalia Wrong, Faith, War and Hope in a Shattered State, and Everything You Have Told Me Is True, The Many Faces of Al-Shabaab. So thank you once again for joining us for this forum as we continue with our eight-country election series in partnership with the Henrik Paul Foundation and the Elephant. My name is Pauline Otieno-Skepa, and I'm the Forum and Education Manager here at the Institute. So in the run-up to these critical elections in 2021, this series intends to provide a longer-term view on the democratic development of the region by providing critical analysis and space for debate on the pertinent issues during this election season. Today's forum will be looking at the upcoming Somalia Index direct elections based on the May agreement for 25th July for the upper house, between 10th August and 10th September for the lower house, with the presidential elections scheduled for 10th October. Though easing tensions, the agreement has left several crucial elements of the electoral process unaddressed, including the selection process of delegates and the mechanism for ensuring the 30% quota for women's seats in parliament, security management, and electoral funding.
Welcome, everybody, and thank you very much, Pauline, for that lovely introduction. I'm just going to introduce the panel, starting with Rukia Mohamed Botan, who's the co-founder and director of Lead Now, which is a movement dedicated to increasing women's participation in politics and public life in Somalia. We also have Idil Ibrahim, who is the program advisor of the Life and Peace Institute. Then we have Abdi Nasir Yusuf, the program manager at the Puntland Development and Research Center. And last but not least, we have Umar Mahmoud of the International Crisis Group. He's their senior Somalia researcher. Umar, it would be good to start with you.
Sure. Thank you, Mary. And just in terms of some quick remarks, in terms of an overview, you know, I think the central point is things are much better than they were a few months ago. You know, you mentioned this at the start of your remarks, Mary, about how difficult it's been this time around getting actors really to agree on the same page. And, you know, I think there's some reasons for that. We can go further into our discussions, but basically the polarization has increased and the stakes are a bit higher this time around. And so that's made it that much more difficult. And we saw that actually result in violence in April. But I think the silver lining from that was that actors kind of saw where that was heading and saw that violence, and everyone's kind of regrouped since then. And, you know, there's a hope that, you know, that was one scenario that, you know, very few people actually want to go down that route. And so since then, we've had reconvening of, you know, the member states and the federal government, some two big meetings that have really pushed forward on electoral implementation. You know, the big difference is now that the prime minister is leading these rather than the president Farmajo himself, and that's put a different face on things. And, you know, I think we've seen some progress. You know, one sign to me was after the 27th May agreement, they had outlined 60 days for that election to happen, the process. And everyone, you know, thought that wasn't very realistic. And they met a month later and then pushed it back to conclude on October 10th. And so, you know, now you're talking about an 8-month extension by default for the executive, and everyone kind of was on the same page on that. And so I think that shows that there's a little bit of a different environment. And, you know, there's not just engagement, but we also see some of the implementation aspects as well. Having said that, though, you know, there's still a lot of thorny issues coming up, and some issues that will actually challenge some of the interests of certain actors. You know, essentially, as you mentioned, this is still an indirect electoral process. In any indirect process like that, the costs of manipulation and interference are lowered. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, we see this battle for control of different aspects of the process ongoing, or really to try to bend implementation to benefit one side or the other. And really, you see almost kind of some of the electoral dynamics playing out before the election itself. And so there's a few key issues here that haven't been resolved, which relate specifically to control, which in turn, you know, relate to, you know, specific seats in the parliament, which in turn will vote for the ultimate prize, the president. So you still have, you know, a situation in Gedo where it's 16 seats are going to be held in the capital there. That's you know, a local reconciliation efforts ongoing, but needs to resolve. You have a similar dynamic in Hirshabelle where things are going on, and also a dispute over the representatives of Somaliland, which, you know, winds up being 57 seats in parliament. So a big aspect. So I think there's some of these thorny issues coming up. There's other technical issues around budget, around, you know, outline some of the details of this process, which, and security preparations as well, which I'm sure we'll get into further in the discussion. So, you know, just to sum and be brief, you know, I'd say that there's a lot of progress that's been made, but a number of key challenges, a number of those are coming up, and it's going to still challenge kind of implementation based on the recent agreements on paper, and, you know, would expect some further hiccups down the road.
Thank you very much, Umar. It would be great to hear about this more from you, Idil, given your experience in the security sector.
Thank you, Mary, and the Rift Valley team for organizing such events needed at the moment. I think security, why we are here in direct election, because of the security, because the country couldn't hold it. It was not ready, you know, because of the fear of Al-Shabaab. And also security, it's also related to political stability in the country. If there's no political stability, so most likely what we have experienced in April, there's a violence. So when you look elections in Somalia, the challenge security-wise they have at the moment, it's like Shabaab threats, because already the identified cities are in most likely the risk of Al-Shabaab attacks, like Barawe, outside the city, it's like they are surrounded. Also Johar, also Dusamareb, despite being safe inside, there were some attacks, even they attacked the government officials. So they are most likely they will have some attacks if we don't be careful in terms of the delegates and also the election commissions. It's also, there's a fear, wider fear. Some politicians, they have that what happened, maybe with the experience of 2016, federal member states or even the federal government will try to block some individuals to bring some loyalties, you know, and already you have some politicians who are already have influential, who already have armed groups. So it may happen a clash and that can create violence. Also, what the fear is around also, maybe the way the federal member states and the president wants to have influence, former presidents, they also want to back their loyalists and go and campaign their hometowns. That's also a fear may can come up. We also have already the issue of the election commissions. Some political members and well-known oppositions are still saying that they can't trust them. How are they neutral? You know, such commissions, how they conduct and they build the trust will also achieve the kind of security during the elections. Yes, at the international community can play a big role, especially AMISOM is already assigned the contentious cities like maybe Gerbahare or Beledweyne. So how they conduct, how do they make sure that AMISOM also, you know, identifies the violence, maybe some things that can create conflict is very important. They are also, they can play a very big role, the international community, also the presidential elections, which is a very big deal. So if any candidate is not going to accept at the end what's next for Somalia, because already we have seen it, what can create and they can build. So it's all that. We also have the Gulf countries. Allegedly, no one is like, we don't have a clear thing, but that money will come because we have the experience of 2016, 2012, all these presidents backed up, you know, how that money will be used. Is it different before? Because we have seen it, that money before it was used for buying votes. Is that money is going again for violence? What's next for Somalia? So how this election is also depends on the maturity of politicians in Somalia, you know, the federal member states and the president, how do the political oppositions will accept the outcome? How do they want to prepare? themselves? Also, why the community? What about the role of civil society? Are they active? What about the media? I think security goes in line with political stability in the country.
Thank you very much, Idil. And now, Rukia, this issue of women, since 2012, there's been this very lofty kind of commitment, really, to having 30% of the political representation being represented by women, but this has not been achieved. And I wonder if this time around, Rukia, are we any closer to that? We have had the declaration of a female presidential candidate this week, but is that just a kind of tokenism? Is she likely to get very far? So it would be great to hear your thoughts on the issue of women and politics in Somalia.
Right. Thank you so much, Mary. And thanks to the panel. Yes, these are all great and critical questions. I think Omar mentioned that after the deadlock, there has been progress. Prior to the deadlock, Somalia has made progress. And then after the deadlock, some concession and compromise have occurred in the political process towards this election selection process. And so that is sort of where the nation's moving. In terms of the woman, it was clear early on that this year, this election cycle was going to be much harder than even 2016, 2017 election cycle, because there was almost at some point zero attempt in providing an inclusive space for women. And I think we as women, we had these conversations in many spaces and we said, what went wrong? Because we achieved 24% quota from 24% women were able to become parliamentarians. So that's progress. Even though on benchmark, the minimum was 30%, getting to 24% was a success or at least a progress towards a more inclusive political space for Somali women. However, how could that process be reverted and what happened this year? One of the most interesting thing was that the conflict within and the chaos that this political cycle created provided a space where it was almost excused that women shouldn't sit in these tables and be part of the problem solving and the peace processes. And one of the other thing was the international community was much more absent this time around. The 2016 election, there was a robust international community that was putting pressure. They were obviously not doing the work. The Somali women were always doing the work, but at least there was allies and we had champions to ensure that women can get through these process, through this clan selection. Now, the lofty 30% quota, that's what it is. There isn't a real political commitment right now as it stands. All the powers are still in the hands of traditional elders and political elites. One of the Baidawa agreement that came out indicated that for example, a clan has three seats. So one of those three seats minimum has to go towards a woman. However, the mechanisms are not clear how that can be achieved and who would be taking responsibility. Is it the traditional elders? Is it the Minister of Interior? Is it the regional presidents or the regional head of state? Is it the federal government? Are these committees equipped to address these challenges? So if there isn't a set of responsibility and a set of mandate, then it just becomes this beautiful language that's sort of added towards the end of each agreement, but it hasn't been concrete. And one of the biggest fear we have now is not only not to gain the 30%, but also lose some of the political wins that we've gained and the 24% of women MPs currently. It might even be less than that if we do not have immediate action.
Thank you, Rukia, and that's pretty depressing to hear that actually things might be going backwards rather than forwards when it comes to women. And Abdi Nasir, if we can turn to you now, there's an interesting experiment going on in Puntland where in local elections in three districts, there's going to be an attempt at least to have one person, one vote model. How successful do you think this is going to be? You know, how is this going to work? Do you think it can be replicated elsewhere in Somalia? I mean, obviously the security issue is a huge problem. So it'd be great to hear your thoughts on that, Abdi Nasir.
Yeah, thank you very much, Maria and the panel for giving me the chance. And before I actually talk about the ongoing and early elections in Puntland, I would like to give you a glimpse of the political and democratization development in Puntland. And I would like to start the establishment of Puntland in 1998 at the Garowe Constitutional Community Conference by the traditional and the political leadership of the Nugal and Bari and Senag and Sur and regions. It actually emerged from the stability that existed in northeastern regions after the collapse of the Somali government that gave it the chance for the community to come together and establish the state that actually helps them develop and the region. Besides the advancements made in the institution building and the governance, it still seems that Puntland is in permanent clan-based transition situation for about now 22 years. On the other hand, there was 6 presidential and parliamentary elections that take place in that 22 years where the parliament of 6 members were being selected by the Isimo and traditional leaders. There was, on the other hand, attempt that Puntland always wanted to transit from the clan-based election system to democracy. And the first attempt towards that end started during the President Flores' term in 2009 and 2014. It started with the establishment of the political electoral and commission and the laws, and also at the adoption of the first Puntland constitution in 2012. And during that period, it was the first time that Puntland also attempted the start of the democratization process in the area. However, 2 or 3 days before the local government elections were to take place across the districts, early election violence actually erupted in certain areas and resulted the process to be suspended.
Abdi Nasir, I just wonder whether you could bring this forward to the current situation and the current plans, just so we have a little bit more time to have a discussion amongst ourselves. That would be really helpful. Thank you. And thanks for the background as well.
Yeah. The process now is actually started with the commitment of the current administration, the current president of Puntland, who actually started the process during the first year of his administration, and the work, the operational and technical aspect that is carried out by the TPEC in putting together everything that's needed for the process to take base, but also to succeed to get the acceptance and the confidence of the people. There's plans now that Puntland is going to hold early elections in 3 districts, in Eyl and Gardo and Ufain, and over 46,000 people have now registered for the elections, and we now hope to have the elections in late in October. This is actually a huge undertaking for Puntland because it's the first time that Puntland is piloting, and the success or the failure of the pilot initiative will determine the fate of the process moving forward. But on the other hand, there is a lesson that can be drawn from the success of the Puntland democratization process. And before I actually talk about how lessons can be drawn from it, I have to also emphasize that Puntland has also benefited from the state building and democratization process of Somaliland, from the origins of its state building to its successive attempts to democratization process. It has always been learning from the experience of Somaliland. So successful democratization and elections in Puntland could also serve the, you know, the foundation for a successful democratization and elections across Somalia at the state, federal and state level. So that is where we are. We have recently held a participatory poll where we have reached out to over 2,500 people in more than 22 districts across the nine regions. And when we asked them if elections can take place in Puntland during the incumbent president's term, over 62% of that people responded positively and believe that elections can be achieved during the president Denis term. We also asked on the grounds on which they will be selecting political associations. And the good news is that over 70% of the people's response was that they will be selecting on its political agenda, while only 4% said they will be selecting on their, you know, affiliation with their clans and clan issues.